Today at Reader's Corner, NPR's Fresh Air book critic Maureen Corrigan, author of So We Read On, How the Great Gatsby Came to Be and Why It Endures. I'm Bob Custra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Many of us remember reading The Great Gatsby years ago in our high school English class. What was it about that slim novel by F. Scott Fitzgerald that was supposedly so great, we may have wondered at the time? And more to the point, why had it remained popular while other seemingly worthy books had faded away? Today's guest, Maureen Corrigan, makes an impassioned case for why The Great Gatsby deserves a second, third, or even fourth look in her delightful book, So We Read On, How the Great Gatsby Came to Be and Why It Endures. It's now out in paperback. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Maureen Corrigan. She is critic in residence at Georgetown University and the book critic on NPR's award-winning program, Fresh Air. She has traveled the country to talk about her favorite books as part of the Big Read program sponsored by the National Endowment for the Arts. And she was a featured speaker last summer at the Sun Valley Writers Conference. Dr. Corrigan joins us from Monitor Studios in Washington, D.C. for this interview. Maureen Corrigan, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much, Bob. It's always a pleasure to talk about Gatsby.
Well, I'll tell you, I feel like I am the A student because, number one, the nuns did not teach me Gatsby in high school, so I had to go read it on my own. And I did that in preparation for this program, but it's very likely I read it earlier in life and just had to go back and get refreshed. Secondly, I read in your book, which, of course, I also read for this interview, that Alan Ladd playing Gatsby was your favorite rendition in the movies, so I rented the movie. I watched Alan Ladd. I feel like I've just about done it all in the way we approach this interview, and I guess I'll start with the obvious question that you must get 1,000 times. You call The Great Gatsby the greatest American novel. Why?
Oh, gosh. Because of its powerhouse poetic language wedded to a complex message about the American dream, in which Fitzgerald says it's beautiful to try, to aspire, but at the same time, we're doomed to failure. So this isn't that novel that some folks may have encountered in high school that is a straightforward sort of boosterish advertisement for the American dream. When you read it carefully, you really understand that Fitzgerald is trying to have it both ways. As someone who was himself a striver, who came from kind of a mixed class background, he understood the importance of yearning, of aspiring. But at the same time, he also tells us the game is sort of rigged. And someone like Gatsby, Mr. Nobody from Nowhere, who tries to be somebody, is ultimately doomed to failure, even though his effort is noble.
So I guess you have to get to the very end of the book to understand your title, So We Read On. I take it that's a takeoff of that last sentence in the book. Help us understand how that sentence works into the message of Gatsby.
Sure. That last sentence in the book, which I know a lot of people have committed to memory, so we beat on, boats against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the past. It has it both ways. You know, it's an American thing to do, to beat on. Maybe it's a human thing to do, to keep trying, to keep reaching, running faster, stretching out our arms farther, as the book says. At the same time, we're ultimately all going to be borne back ceaselessly into the past, whether you read that last phrase as being enfolded in the arms of death or our own personal past catch up with us. There's a kind of a pessimistic note at the end of that phrase. By the way, that sentence, that famous closing line of The Great Gatsby, was originally at the end of chapter one. If you go on Princeton University Library's website, Princeton has the original manuscript copy of Gatsby in its collections. They've digitized the manuscript, so you can go online, follow the prompts, and you too can look at the first draft of The Great Gatsby, the manuscript, in Fitzgerald's beautiful Catholic schoolboy handwriting, and you will see that that, you know, boffo last line of The Great Gatsby is actually at the end of the first chapter. It's also the line that's inscribed on Fitzgerald's gravestone. Not far from where I live in Washington, D.C., he's buried in Rockville, Maryland, mm-hmm. and that last line is on his gravestone.
So many of our listeners read The Great Gatsby back in high school. What did you think of the novel when you read it in high school?
You know, I can barely remember that first reading. The only takeaway I have from that first reading is that I was unmoved. I was like, eh, what's the big deal? I went to high school in Astoria, Queens, which for those listeners who know the landscape of the novel, you know that Astoria, Queens is not all that far from the Valley of Ashes, Flushing Meadow, which is the real spot that inspired the Valley of Ashes in the novel. I came from a blue-collar background, went to a Catholic high school. I thought this was kind of a boring novel about rich people and put it aside. But then I went to grad school and had to teach the novel as a teaching assistant. And certainly by the second, the third time I reread the novel, Nick Carraway's voice is what drew me in. That voice of yearning for his dead friend Gatsby. It's so powerful. Again, that was a change that Fitzgerald made with the novel. When he originally wrote The Great Gatsby the first time out, he had a third-person omniscient narrator. Nick did not tell the story. And what a great change that was to insert Nick as our narrator.
So when I watched the movie with Alan Ladd and McDonald Carey playing Nick Carraway, I noticed that Nick did not at all appreciate setting up Gatsby with Daisy, because he's like, hey, excuse me, this woman's married. What are you doing trying to mess up this marriage between Tom Buchanan and Daisy? Does that come out as much in the book as it does in the movie?
Not as much in the book, no.
I didn't think so.
That 1949 version, I think, is a lot of fun. It's not Gatsby either, but yeah. I love it because it does really bring to the fore the crime noir element of Gatsby. You know, the fact that mm-hmm. Gatsby, he is a gangster. The name Gatsby derives from 1920s slang for a machine gun was a gat. And that first scene, as you know, where you see Gatsby in the novel, Alan Ladd as Gatsby, he's leaning out of a speeding roadster, machine gunning down his rivals in the bootlegging business. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we could go on and on about that. But I love that 1949 version gives Gatsby his criminal due. I think critics today might say that Nick is reluctant to set Gatsby up with his cousin Daisy, not so much because she's already married, but because Nick has such strong feelings for Gatsby himself. I mean, mm-hmm. you probably know there's a huge body of criticism these days that talks about the homoerotic element in Gatsby. And it's true that Fitzgerald himself felt that the novel didn't do well in 1925 when it first came out, because there were no favorable female characters, and the primary relationship was between two men.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, this is a guy who ends up dying at age 44 in 1940, not having the slightest idea that he was much of a success, at least as far as The Great Gatsby is concerned.
Yeah, it's such a heartbreaking story. I'm sentimental enough to sometimes go to the graveside and to say to Fitzgerald, you did it. You really did write the great American novel. I want to hope that somehow he knows. He dies in Hollywood, as you say, at the age of 44 of what was probably his third heart attack. By the way, he was reading the Princeton Alumni Bulletin when he died. He went to Princeton. He was checking off the names of the promising football players on that season's team. This was in December when he died. And I've seen that issue of the Princeton Alumni Bulletin with Fitzgerald's pencil marks. And you see the check marks, and then you see the pencil go off the page, and you know he's had his heart attack. At the time that he died, Fitzgerald himself couldn't even buy copies of The Great Gatsby in Hollywood, L.A. bookstores. Sheila Graham, who was his lover at the time, writes that he would go into bookstores. He'd want to give people copies of Gatsby. And some of the booksellers looked at him They were astonished. They thought he had died. He was so far off the map by 1940 that people really didn't even think of him. The New York Times obituary for Fitzgerald in 1940 doesn't even mention the Great Gatsby. It mentions This Side of Paradise, which came out in 1920. It's the novel that made his reputation. It gave us the phrase the Jazz Age. He was considered a relic of the Roaring Twenties by the time he died.
I'm Bob Custer. Today I'm speaking with Maureen Corrigan about her new book, So We Read On, How the Great Gatsby Came to Be and Why It Endures. He may have had a heart attack, but he drank himself to death, it sounds like, from his bio. What is it about these guys and alcohol? Jim Harrison just died, and he certainly abused the bottle. And Hemingway, I mean, there must be a dissertation out there in departments of English that link these two together to help us try to figure this out.
There's something better than a dissertation, and I can say that as somebody who's written a dissertation, and you know what I mean because you wrote one too.
Right.
There's a great book by Olivia Lang called The Trip to Echo Spring that came out, I think it was 2 years ago, and it's about Fitzgerald, Hemingway, Tennessee Williams, and it's precisely about this subject, the link between creativity and depression and alcoholism. And it's a great study. But certainly Fitzgerald had enough to be depressed about. Zelda had been in and out of mental institutions.
His wife,
Zelda Fitzgerald, from the time that she was 30. So there was that. There was the fact that, right, he was constantly having money problems, many of them self-created. He and Zelda loved to live high on the hog. You know, they loved to rent mansions and throw parties. And as soon as money came in from his writings, Fitzgerald was spending the money. But by the 1930s, when he had gone out of fashion, people considered him really out of step with the dirty 30s, the Depression era literature of the time. He was also supporting his daughters, Scottie Fitzgerald, who was going to private schools. And Fitzgerald, you know, one of the things I love about him is that he was a good father. He was a tiger dad. He was always on his daughter Scottie's back about her grades and her behavior and her appearance, but he really cared. So he had a lot of economic and psychological burdens. It took him so long to finally write Tender is the Night, 1934, the novel after Gatsby, and that did not do well either. So he really felt the pressure of being a washed-up writer. Like so many writers, so many of our great American writers, he goes out to Hollywood in 1936, and he's treated like a hand by the studios. He's brought in to doctor scripts. He even works for 2 weeks on Gone with the Wind, and then he's pulled off of that movie. He just really felt like basically a factory hand there, and he was very depressed.
Mm-hmm. So what led to Gatsby's resurgence? I mean, today I called up my grandson, who's in a suburban high school in Chicago. Hey, Brendan, he's a junior in high school. Hey, Brendan, did you read The Great Gatsby? Oh, yeah, read it when I was a freshman. Loved it. Yeah. That was the reaction I got in 2016. So clearly, if Scott Fitzgerald was around today, he'd be pretty pleased at how many people, at least in their younger years, are reading The Great Gatsby. What accounts for this resurgence in over the years?
The resurgence started to happen as soon as Fitzgerald died. His well-placed literary friends, people like Dorothy Parker, his great publisher, Maxwell Perkins, about whom a movie is coming out, I think, next month with Colin Firth playing Maxwell Perkins. Yeah, be still my heart.
Really?
But folks really worked hard to get Fitzgerald's works back in print. So there's that in the 1940s. But then there's this movement, as I say, from the bottom up, which is really interesting. It's a story that not a lot of people know about these books, paperback books that were distributed during World War II. They were called the Armed Services Editions, and they're printed on cheap pulp paper, very flimsy kind of covers on them, stapled, hardly any margins. What happened was that publishers, editors, librarians, paper manufacturers, booksellers, they all get together in New York in the early years of World War II. They want to do something for the war effort. And they come up with the idea that soldiers and sailors serving overseas need something to read. So they decide to publish all of these varied titles, over 1,000 titles, everything from Moby Dick and the Odyssey to the latest Rex Stout mystery, My Friend Flicka. They publish over 123 million titles and distribute them overseas. The greatest distribution, by the way, was on the eve of D-Day. Every guy going over in a landing craft had an armed services edition tucked into his pocket. They were rectangular, meant to fit into the servicemen's pockets. And in 1945, just as the war ended, we get 155,000 copies of The Great Gatsby distributed. And by the end of the 40s, well, we already know, you get another Great Gatsby movie. The first biography is in the early 50s of F. Scott Fitzgerald. Lots of criticism. I did a search at the Library of Congress here in Washington of collections of anthologies of American literature from the 30s, 40s, 50s. I wanted to try to figure out, when does Fitzgerald enter the canon? Because, as we know, he was nowhere upon his death. He never won any of the big literary prizes like Hemingway did or Faulkner did. No Nobel Prize, no Pulitzer Prize. When does he become required reading for high school students and college students? And it's really the mid to late 50s that you find his short stories being assigned all the time and included in these anthologies. And by the early 60s, Gatsby is on everybody's radar. Now it covers not just the nation, but the world. If people are teaching American literature overseas, they're teaching Gatsby. My own book has been translated into Korean and Russian, and I have no illusions it's because of me. It's because of the fascination with Gatsby as an American icon.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Maureen Corrigan, author of So We Read On, How the Great Gatsby Came to Be and Why It Endures. You've mentioned her before. What role does Scottie Fitzgerald, his daughter, play in this, along with, it sounds like her partner in some ways, Matthew Brookley? This is an amazing story of somebody just deciding to keep it going.
Yes, yes. I think Scottie Fitzgerald should be in the Daughters of Great Writers Hall of Fame. Boy, does she deserve a medal. She met a young scholar, Matthew Brookley, in the early 60s. They were at an auction outside of Baltimore where Scottie had donated some first editions of her father's story collections. And Brookley was bidding on some Fitzgerald books and wasn't getting them. He was outbid. And after the auction, she approached him and gave him an edition. Brookley had first become fascinated with Fitzgerald as a senior in high school in the 1950s when he heard a radio play as he was in his parents' car one Sunday afternoon going on a drive. He heard a radio play of the short story, The Diamond as Big as the Ritz. And he thought, I've got to read more of this guy. He went to his high school library and there was no Fitzgerald to be found. But that started Brookley on this quest to read Fitzgerald. And ultimately, he became the foremost Fitzgerald scholar, I think, of the 20th century. He's the one who brings out what I think what a lot of us consider to be still the best biography of Fitzgerald, as well as loads of other editions. But the great story about Scottie actually occurs before her partnership with Matthew Brookley. When Fitzgerald died, everything, his estate was left to Zelda. And because Zelda had never been declared insane, she suffered from either bipolar disorder or a paranoid schizophrenia. The diagnoses differ. Because she had never been declared insane, she really still had control of the estate, of all the manuscripts and everything else that Fitzgerald left to her. She was being advised to sell things off piecemeal because the family needed money. And Scottie Fitzgerald, their daughter, put her foot down and said, no, it should all go to Princeton University, which Fitzgerald had loved and, you know, attended as a young man. Princeton University at first didn't want Fitzgerald's manuscripts. They weren't interested. By the mid-40s, Scotty tries again to give the manuscripts, to sell the manuscripts to Princeton, and they offer her $1,000 for everything, including the manuscript of The Great Gatsby. At this point, an editor from Scribner's, Fitzgerald's publisher, gets involved. He thinks Princeton's behavior is disgraceful. And Julian Boyd, who was the university librarian at Princeton at the time, said, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but I've committed this response to memory. Julian Boyd said to the Scribner's editor, Princeton is not in the business of supporting indigent Southern widows of Midwestern hack writers who had the good fortune to attend Princeton, even if it was not Princeton's good fortune. Imagine. Oh, gosh. So what does Scotty Fitzgerald do? She gives everything to Princeton. Why? Because she wants Fitzgerald's papers, which means, among other things, his manuscripts, his letters. She wants them all together in one place so that they can be available to future scholars. What a generous and what a brave and wise act. Mm-hmm. And so I really have nothing but admiration for Scotty Fitzgerald.
So you revisited your old high school in Queens to discuss this novel. I thought that was one of the most fascinating parts of the book. Tell us a little bit about, first of all, what you learned about the students there, how life has changed since Maureen was in the class of your teacher who was still there, of all things. And then what it taught you about where and when it's proper to read and teach Gatsby.
Yeah, I hadn't been back to my old high school in almost 40 years. So if anyone out there wants a humbling experience, go back. The students look at you like, you know, an exhumed dinosaur from the Paleolithic era. I don't know. I went back to my whole old high school because by the time my students at Georgetown University come into my classes, they've read Gatsby already. And I wanted to get a sense of what high school students say the first time they encounter Gatsby. And then I thought, well, what better place to kind of carry out this investigation than my own old high school where I first read Gatsby? And I spent 2 days at my old high school. I really had to think twice about my assumption that we read Gatsby when we're too young. I really, as I said earlier, I connected with Gatsby later on, you know, in my 20s, granted, but later on because I really started to understand Nick Carraway's voice of yearning, of regret. And my feeling was kids in high school are too young to have many regrets. They can't connect with this novel. But when I sat in on those classes, I encountered a different response to Gatsby. Those students really identified with Jay Gatsby's over-the-topness, with his idea that he could fly as high as he could dream, you know, and it didn't matter if ultimately he fell down in the end, that they really identified with his aspiration. And I love that about the conversations in class. In fact, those students didn't like Nick Carraway very much. They thought he was a sellout because at the end of the novel, as people might remember, after Gatsby is dead, Nick actually shakes Tom Buchanan's hand. And Tom Buchanan has not been a good friend to Gatsby. I won't go further into the plot in case people are rereading it again with a hazy memory. But Tom is not a good man. And Nick decides to shake his hand anyway. The students in my old high school didn't like that. They didn't feel that Nick was pure enough. And they do love the purity of Gatsby's dreams and aspirations.
So it's a fact of life, I think, that people by now listening to us talk about this novel are going to want to go out and either read it or see it. And since the latest version is going to be the one easiest to get their hands on, you have to comment on the Leonardo DiCaprio version of The Great Gatsby and also what we might be missing if that's the only way we choose to remember The Great Gatsby.
I think Baz Luhrmann does a good job portraying the over-the-topness of the story. You know, that's certainly something, again, that those students at my old high school responded to. I really like Carey Mulligan as Daisy. I think she does a good job. And by the way, I heard when I visited Princeton myself that she actually came to Princeton to look at the manuscript and some of the letters of Zelda Fitzgerald. She wanted to try to get a sense of what Zelda was like, since she's one of the inspirations for Daisy's character. What I don't like about Leonardo DiCaprio's portrayal is that he seems too at ease in his own skin. He's too confident as Gatsby. And if anybody reads Gatsby, you know, not even carefully, but just with an eye toward how the character is portrayed, you see that Gatsby himself is very nervous. He's never at ease. He's a guy who doesn't even settle down at his own parties. He's always sidling into rooms. He's nervous about his own class position in this society. And he's very much aware of being James Gatz, you know, from the Midwest. So he's not at ease. And I think DiCaprio almost played Gatsby a bit too much like he was Donald Trump. He's too arrogant. He's too confident. So that I didn't love. And I can't forgive Baz Luhrmann for leaving out the most significant line about Daisy in the novel. At one point, we hear Jay Gatsby say that Daisy's voice is full of money. And that's a really important line. It really smashes together the fact that she's so alluring. Again, part of the allure is because she's a rich girl. Rich girls always held allure for the characters in Fitzgerald's stories. And for some reason, Luhrmann left that line out. So he gets a C minus from me for his All right. Adaptation of The Great Gatsby.
So for our listeners who go out to buy a copy of The Great Gatsby, give them some idea of how many other people will be buying this book in 1 year.
Yeah, in a normal year, and I've gotten these figures straight from Scribner's, which is still Fitzgerald's publisher. In a normal year, you have something like 500,000 new copies of The Great Gatsby sold. Those would be new paperbacks for the most part in the Scribner's edition. That doesn't include electronic editions. That doesn't include, you know, resales of secondhand books. 500,000 worldwide. And now this figure is about 3 years out of date. Worldwide, Scribner's estimates that 25 million copies of The Great Gatsby have been sold. Now, in the year 3 years ago when the movie came out, Scribner said that that figure of 500,000 pretty much tripled. So, I mean, it's just astounding, and it's certainly a novel that deserves to sell that many copies. I do think it's our great American novel. It's certainly, I think, our greatest American novel about class. Almost every other novel that's been nominated as a great American novel candidate foregrounds race, which may be our great American subject. But this is the novel that foregrounds class, which is certainly another important subject in American life.
Mm-hmm. Maureen, we've run out of time. I am just delighted that you were able to spend some time with us and talk about your book, which, of course, is So We Read On, How the Great Gatsby Came to Be and Why It Endures. Again, Maureen Corrigan, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Oh, thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Maureen Corrigan. Next week, Michael Waldman, author of The Fight to Vote. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Deborah Palmer. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. You can find out what's coming up next on our show and listen to previous interviews online on our website. That's BoiseStatePublicRadio.org, or check out our podcast, Reader's Corner.